This is Bill Aldifer of the State Historical Society of Wisconsin staff interviewing Professor Aaron Ide here at the Historical Society building on May 21st, 1963. We're continuing a second tape relating to the history of science, and in particular to Professor Ide and his work in this field. The place we left off was where Professor Ide was giving some anecdotal sketches of prominent you call them the old timers.
The old timers in the biochemistry department.
In biochemistry.
Yeah.
And you had some more to say about Professor Link.
Yes, we were talking about Carl Paul Link at the time that the last tape came to an end in mid-sentence. Link has been a very unusual person on the university faculty, a rather controversial figure in many ways. He took issue with Conrad Alvium at the time that Alvium was chairman of the biochemistry department and dean of the graduate school. They disagreed on many things, but Link broke into public print in connection with obstructionism that he thought Alvium was guilty of, in connection with the use of anticoagulants discovered in Link's laboratory in aspirin. After all, aspirin is related in structure to dicumarol, which is the anticoagulant of spoiled sweet clover hay. And Link recognized this relationship and was able to demonstrate that aspirin also has anticoagulant effect. So it struck him that if aspirin is going to cause the blood to lose its clotting ability, that something ought to be done to correct this harm done by aspirin, and he introduced the idea of adding vitamin K to aspirin. I believe that he sought to have this patented. I'm not sure of the details anymore, but the WARF apparently didn't wish to pursue the matter. I believe they picked up a patent on it and then did nothing to promote the patent, as Link thought should have been done.
How widespread was this controversy? Was this just a campus-wide controversy? Or
well, it got into the Capital Times, and it was picked up, I think, by the National News Services, and hit the public print to some extent. It was a rather bitter, hard-fought controversy, with WARF in the middle of it trying to hush everybody up. Well, this is, I think, an example of the sort of thing that Link would do. More cautious people would have tried to work behind the scenes and get this issue resolved. Link, in a forthright manner, made an openly public issue out of it. He, of course, was one of the first university faculty to appear in charts, and his students generally ran around all summer with hairy legs showing, causing a great deal of talk and comment around the biochemistry building and other parts of the campus. I am sure that if anybody commented to Link about this, that he would raise a great hue and cry about the right of people to dress as they damn please. I suppose, was more or less in continuous controversy with his colleagues during the years before he I picked up the TB bug and had to spend about a year in the sanitarium.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
When he was released from the sanitarium, he immediately made the headlines by commenting upon the unsatisfactory conditions for patients. He has quieted down a good deal in the last 10 years. His research activities have become less active, and he hasn't been slugging it out quite as much with his opponents. He had a second bout with tuberculosis. He's presumably cured, or at least able to lead a fairly normal life. But it has had its effect, slowed him down. Perhaps age has also tended to mellow him, as it
I see.
Frequently
yeah.
does.
has he ever commented about his, we'll call it the rat poison episode? Has he ever indicated how he came across this particular, well, I guess you could call it a revolutionary
A revolutionary idea in eliminating rodents.
Rodents, yeah.
Yes, it certainly is. I'm sure that he has commented on it very frequently. I can't give you any particular anecdotes. I know in the early days that they were testing this stuff that he consumed some of it himself claimed that it was harmless to human beings. I would be inclined to question the idea that it's perfectly harmless. Virtually anything that one consumes can have unfavorable effects at a high enough level.
Yeah.
But at any rate, it seems not to have as much effect on human beings as it does on rodents. And for this reason, it's a particularly
yeah.
effective rodenticide.
Mm-hmm.
Link is the sort of person who is concerned about the public welfare, and he would not want something to come out of his laboratory that was decidedly dangerous to human beings. And in comparison with most rat poisons on the market, why, this mm-hmm. is a very mild-acting thing. And while it can kill a person's pets if they consume enough of it, why, if it's used as a bait with, say, ground corn, something like that, why, cats and dogs are not very apt to get toxic doses of it. So that while it's potentially harmful, if it's used properly, and of course this is true of all pesticides, if used properly, why, there's not too much to be concerned about.
Mm-hmm.
It's the improper use that
yes. Yes.
Rachel Carson and I are screaming about.
Oh, how about that? Maybe this is a good place. No, of course, your position is known and through the newspapers and this sort of thing. I think that's been well publicized, and as has her
yes.
position, certainly,
mm-hmm.
probably better publicized.
Yes. Oh, yes, very much so.
Yeah.
My own comments, I don't think, have gone beyond the local scene.
Well,
but hers have had nationwide reaction, and it's quite interesting at the moment that the President's Committee on Pesticides has very much bolstered her position.
Bolstered her position.
Very recently,
mm-hmm.
yes. Mm-hmm.
Is there potential damage in her position to scientific learning or experimentation?
Well, I can't be convinced that there is extreme damage. The entomologists and the agriculturalists generally are screaming, but it's because one of their pets has been kicked.
Yeah.
But I can't feel that she has been unreasonable. Her position is that she's not presenting a balanced point of view. She's presenting a record of the misuse of
mm-hmm.
pesticides. She has done it very honestly, very straightforwardly. On page 12 of her book, she says that she is not against the use of agricultural pesticides, but she wants them used with responsibility,
mm-hmm.
not reckless.
Yeah.
And I think no one can...
You can't. argue that effectively.
There's been an exceedingly bitter and interesting controversy at the faculty level on this whole thing. Historians might be interested in recording sometime.
Yes. Well, this, of course, it's still going on. I suppose this is not the time.
I thought that it has settled, and
would you want to sketch it at all at this time?
Well, if you want it on record, I might point out that WHA precipitated the crisis when Carl Schmitt read Silent Spring on Chapter a Day, and the entomology department reacted violently and charged WHA with, essentially perpetuating calling public attention to what they considered a fraud, and demanded equal time to respond. WHA set up a radio panel which contained people that were both pro and con, but mostly con, that is, against the Rachel Carson book. This was put on the air, but in setting up the panel, the chairman of the entomology department bumped one of the people who had been invited and would not appear unless he were taken off the original panel. So WHA set up a second panel. The members of this one were Hassler, Cottam, Iltis, Van Potter, Jim Crow, and myself, with Carl Schmitt as moderator. It happened that the whole panel was pro-Carson. The entomology department taped this when it was broadcast and spent 3 months analyzing it, and then sent out a rather vicious critique to all of us and to many other people at the faculty level, essentially charging that none of us were competent to speak about the subject, since to their knowledge, none of us had ever been involved in large-scale application of a pesticide. None of us had. But still, with interest in food, physiology, cancer, ecology, many aspects of biology, all of us felt as if we had some concern about this matter. Well, the thing seems to be dying down unless we get another critique. I have a very interesting file of letters that went back and forth.
Well, you should say those by all means. Now, let's get on to another biochemist, Mr. Steenbach.
Yes.
Who is still living.
Yes, Steenbach is still living. He's about 80 years of age. Has not been active in biochemical activities for about 15 years, but was certainly one of the giants in the development of American biochemistry, and particularly in the nutrition phase of biochemistry. In looking at the history of biochemistry, it's really a pretty young science. And the nutrition phase of it is now complete, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
That is, the knowledge of trace compounds, trace elements, has been explored very, very thoroughly. And after about 1945, there has been very little added. I presume that from time to time there will be minor advances. But they will be encountered in connection with very unusual diets that are somehow deficient. An instance of this is the disease Kwari Kwari in Africa, where the deficiency is due to protein, to lack of protein in the diet. So there will no doubt be other examples of this sort of thing in isolated parts of the world where a diet is narrowly restrictive, but I would say that the nutrition phase of biochemistry is complete. Today, biochemistry is deeply involved in intermediary metabolism, the role of enzymes, the exact route by which compounds are broken down into the final products of energy metabolism, things of that sort. So the biochemists of the UW department that I am talking about are the vitamin, the nutrition people. So Steenbach did his student work at the UW and just simply worked into the department, went up through the ranks. Steenbach is rather colorless as a person. He's a very sincere, a very sober person. Rather slow in speech and thought, but nevertheless very hard working. During the days that the vitamin D irradiation was worked out, I understand that he lived and slept in the laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
He worked his students very hard. The student group looked upon him as a sort of slave driver. They were expected to be in the laboratory early in the morning. They were expected to work late at night. And he was there most of the time to see that they were working.
Mm-hmm.
You occasionally saw a speck of humor in the man, but it didn't come out very often. Generally pretty serious.
Yeah.
He, at the time that he made the irradiation discovery, his laboratory group was rather small. It grew with the years. The patenting of vitamin of irradiation brought a good income to WARF and also to Steenbach, and he was able to use grants to support a quite sizable research group, including people at the postdoctoral level. He ran a laboratory which I suppose would be quite similar to those of the German universities, where there is the professor who is the head man and everything clears through him. At the time that I was doing my minor work with Steenbach, he had two post-PhD level people who today would be called project associates. At that time they were simply, well, I think they were called instructors, but they had very little teaching obligation and were largely the people who stood between Steenbach and the graduate students. They themselves did a good deal of research. And they were around all of the time to help the graduate students with their immediate problems. One of these people is now Steenbach's wife.
Oh, is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Evelyn Van Donk was in his laboratory as an associate for a number of years. Then she left Wisconsin and took some kind of a position in the East, and in about a year or two, when she came back as Steenbach's bride.
Mm-hmm.
He was married very late in life.
Mm-hmm.
And the laboratory was a very busy one. It was a rather humorless
mm-hmm.
one.
Mm-hmm.
Steenbach was interested in all phases of fat-soluble vitamins. McCollum, when he was at Wisconsin up to 1918, had opened up the fat-soluble vitamin idea, but at the time that he left Wisconsin, it still was not clear that there were at least two of these factors. Steenbach had played a fairly important role in unraveling the distinction between the anti-ophthalmic factor, that is the factor that prevented sore eyes, and which is also a growth factor, and the factor which prevented rickets, the so-called vitamin D, according to the McCollum nomenclature, which was introduced in the 20s.
Mm-hmm.
Steinbach, for example, recognized that yellow corn was better than white corn in preventing the growth deficiency and the eye deficiency. But that was a slow recognition that this had nothing to do with rickets prevention. The actual discovery of the radiation of foods is another one of these things that grows gradually. A Dane and certain other investigators had recognized that rickets can be prevented by plenty of sunshine. And only gradually did Steinbach at Wisconsin and Hess at Columbia begin to notice the obvious, that is, that sunshine could also bring about conversion of a precursor into the vitamin itself when food was exposed. Steinbach beat Hess by just a matter of weeks in publishing the irradiation experiment.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of this, WARF was had first rights to any patents that were involved. If Steinbach had not made the discovery, why, Hess would have come out with it very soon thereafter, and it would have happened.
Mm-hmm.
But both of these men were very much in the forefront of what was going on in this field.
That's interesting. Men, did they know what each other was doing?
I doubt it.
Is this a matter of
unless they could deduce it from one another's publications.
Mm-hmm.
They, of course, were reading everything that came out in the Journal of Biological Chemistry, and they knew what the other was doing, but I'm not sure that they had a suspicion that the other one was right on top of the discovery when they were working on it.
Would Steinbach engage in controversy as a Carl Paul Link?
Steinbach would defend his position, defend his ideas, in fact do so vehemently if necessary. He didn't go out looking for trouble, but he didn't avoid trouble if it was coming his way.
I see.
So that he was involved in various controversies. They never flared up in the dramatic way that that Link's controversies flared up. Link and Steinbach had little use for each other. In fact, around 1942, there was a washroom incident in which Link allegedly took a poke at Steinbach. Yeah, so there was quite bad blood between
them. Was this a professional jealousy? You're discovering more than I'm discovering, or did this go deeper than that?
I think it went deeper. I think it was a personality matter. Link was an outspoken individual who had a great tendency to needle people.
I see.
Steinbach was thin-skinned and didn't take needling. He had a little sense of repartee.
Mm-hmm.
Some people could rib Link right back.
Yes.
And Link took it and enjoyed it.
Nice.
But Steinbach was not that kind of a person. Rather slow thinking, little humor, and he certainly wouldn't immediately think of the right wisecrack to put Link in his place. If he did reply, why, it would be a deep-seated resentment type of reply.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, E.B. Hart was the chairman of the department during all these years, and E.B. Hart ranks high as a diplomat. He had a bunch of prima donnas in his opera company, and he managed to keep peace with them, between them for over three decades. So, of course, he was a man of first-class ability, too.
He knew what he had.
He knew what he had.
He knew what he had there.
And so he put them in different parts of the building and kept them apart as much as possible. I suppose the departmental meetings got pretty rough at times. But Hart could be rough on occasion.
Mm-hmm.
And he was respected by everybody. Link respected him. much more than he respected Elvium, I'm sure. Steinbach respected him. And the other members of the biochemistry department had the utmost respect for him. He was a good biochemist. He was an exemplary person. He had a good sense of humor. It wasn't a riotous sense of humor, but he saw the humor in virtually everything that came along, and had a rather subtle wit that could take the strain off of the strained situation.
Yeah. And there must have been many of those.
There were many of those, yes. Yeah. That's right.
Now, as a biochemist, that is, as a scientist, did he innovate in the sense that Link and
nothing as important as Link's and Steinbach's innovations, though he made a variety of what might be called minor contributions over the years, some of them of much more than really minor importance.
Mm-hmm.
For example, his work in the in revealing that copper is an essential constituent of the diet was very important in unraveling the whole picture of anemia.
Oh.
Yes.
Oh,
yeah. Elvium was involved in this work along with Hart, but together they were able to prepare exceedingly low copper diets and show that animals went downhill on these diets, that the blood became anemic, and that a slight trace of copper in the diet would prevent this deficiency. This was rather difficult experimental work because copper is present in traces virtually in everything that you come in touch with. So it's hard to get a diet that is completely lacking in copper. But they did the work necessary to prepare such a diet. They must have had a suspicion that copper played a role.
Yeah.
In larger amounts, it's of course toxic.
Yeah.
But tiny traces are essential. So this is one piece of work that Hart was involved in. He was involved in the work which revealed the cause of hairless pigs. That is, Wisconsin farmers were having a good deal of trouble with pigs that were born prematurely and hairless, never survived birth. And Hart was among those who showed that iodine is the cause of this deficiency. And of course, the whole central part of the United States is an iodine deficient belt. The Mayo Clinic got its start in surgery on goiter. And of course, this is a place where there was plenty of opportunity to do surgery on goiter.
Yeah.
This whole thing was whipped in the 1920s, iodized salt.
Yeah.
Some cities began adding iodine to the water supply, though that dropped out of the picture fairly early, and school children began to be fed iodine tablets.
Yeah.
And farmers began buying iodized salt for their farm animals. Though the salt became violet colored on standing around, and Hart's group worked on this and showed that the iodide in the salt, which is colorless originally, was getting oxidized to free iodine, and this was being lost, so they introduced a system for preventing this from taking mm-hmm. place. That became another WARF patent.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think it ever brought a large income, but it was one of the minor patents.
Mm-hmm.
So Hart was doing very respectable work, and everybody in the department treated him with the respect that he deserved, so he could hold the department together in spite of all of these prima donnas.
We're kind of running down here. I don't think it'd be profitable to get into another person until I turn the tape over.
Probably not.
But how responsive were these biochemists to the lure of of industrial patents. Did this play any part in their in any of them, in any of their
not to my knowledge, no. Of course, WARF was set up to handle the Steenbach patent, and I think that all of them recognized that they would be better off by developing an organization that could feed money back into the university.
I'm going to test this to see that our voices are being recorded just for a moment here. Now this is side two of our recording. Now we don't have a budget. Now you were going to make some observations on Professor Peterson. What was his full name?
It was William E., I believe. Peterson.
William E.
Affectionately known around the laboratory as Pete.
As Pete.
Yes, I'm not sure that his students ever called him that to his face, but his colleagues spoke of him in this way, and I know his students did when he was not around. Peterson was the fermentation biochemist, and his work was perhaps as much bacteriological as it was biochemical. He and E.B. Fred did a great deal of collaborative research on the nature of fermentation processes. They did very extensive studies of fermentation in silage and sauerkraut, and pioneered in clarifying the major pathway that was being taken by the compounds that were undergoing fermentation. They isolated a great many constituents from sauerkraut, silage, and other fermented products, published a great many papers together. Peterson was a large and rather formidable appearing man. I would classify him as being closer to the Steenbach type in temperament than to any of the other members of the biochemistry department. I only seemed to know him well in his very late years after he had retired, and he seemed to have much more of a sense of humor than Steenbach did, but nothing like that at heart. He was a very hard-working person. In fact, the biochemists all seemed to be very hard-working, spending long hours in the laboratory, and driving their graduate students very high. Each one of them seemed to have a mix of his own, and there was very little interplay between the various biochemists as far as their areas of research was concerned, except for Aldrin and Hart. Many appeared as joint authors of papers, especially in Adrian's early years. W.E. Cottingham was the other senior member of the department in this period that I speak of. Cottingham must have come to Wisconsin by 1910 and completed the original group. There were really no additions to the original group until Aldrin was shut down. So each of these men was soon to become a mature individual in his field, and no younger men stayed on for a long time. Cottingham was the perfect Mr. Milkshake. He was indecisive, uncomfortable, never sure of himself, always careful to present every point of view, and careful to give no clue as to what his own position was. He never indulged in controversy that he could possibly avoid, but he continually got himself caught in the middle in a very innocent fashion.
Oh dear.
And became very embarrassed and generally made things worse before he got out of the way of the bricks that were flying.
What was his particular contribution?
His particular field of research was plant biochemistry. He had taken his PhD at Johns Hopkins in plant physiology. Of course, the borderline between physiology and biochemistry is essentially non-existent, so he became a member of the biochemistry department. His work was pretty unspectacular compared to the rest of the work that was coming out of the department. I think the man suffered from an inferiority complex because he always wanted to turn out something great and never quite managed to turn out something at the same level of significance that the others were doing. He never had a large group of graduate students, and his courses were not particularly thought out. As you can imagine, he presented students with a great many points of view, but they never quite knew which point of view to take. Since the master wasn't familiar with that. As a person, he was an exceedingly kind individual, very well-meaning, very religious in a formal sense. But quite ineffective and quite uncomfortable. In another university where he perhaps was the only biochemist, he may have been far more successful than he was here. I suppose that his most important work was done on the darkening of potatoes. This was not because he had a particular interest in this subject. He happened to be around when the problem was becoming important in Wisconsin agriculture, and it was more or less stressed out, and he had to do something with it. So this is the older group of biochemists. They're now all retired, and several of them are dead.
Cottingham, is he retired, or?
Cottingham died before retirement. He died about 1945, or thereabouts. He would have had, I suspect, another 5 or 10 years to go. I think a heart attack took him. I could well know.
Did he have any heirs or living in Madison?
He has a son, Robert Cottingham, who does quite a bit of singing. In Madison Music Circle.
Oh, yeah. Certainly.
I am not certain that he makes his living by music, but he has a good voice, and frequently on Madison Circle.
Now, the next group of men, I guess, are loosely defined as people in the field of chemistry. We have here Leister.
History of science. Particularly history of chemistry, but the general area of history of science.
I copied down a few names that we've talked about before. Is that right? Is it Leister?
It's pronounced Leister.
Leister.
Spelled Leicester. Henry Leicester has been quite active in the history of chemistry field in the U.S. Professionally, he is a biochemist with the School of Dentistry of the San Francisco College of Physicians and Surgeons. He does not teach history of chemistry, but he has written extensively in the field. He has a large number of published articles. He has he is author of one book on history of chemistry and co-author of a source book on the subject. He is editor of the annual known as CHEMIA, CHYMIA, which is the scholarly journal in the history of chemistry field. Mm-hmm. He has been editor of the New York since its inception about 1948.
Mm-hmm. He must have had something to do with the founding of it.
Yes, he did. Mm-hmm. He was, at that time, I think, chairman of the History of Chemistry Division of the American Chemical Society. A spot which he held for 5 years, which I think is some indication of his importance in the field.
Yes.
He received the Dexter Award last September. The Dexter Award is a $1,000 award set up by the Dexter Chemical Company of Long Island for important work in the history of chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
It has been given, I think, about 7 times. Lester has sort of drifted into history of chemistry, as is my own case. He was trained as a biochemist and has worked professionally on the biochemistry of tea. But his avocation in history of chemistry, and he's contributed a very great deal to it. He's especially interested in Russian contributions to chemistry. The Dexter Award address dealt with the contributions of the Russian chemist. He's a versatile linguist. Each time that you see him, if there's about a year interval between, the question you're likely to ask is, well, what language are you studying now?
Is that right?
He uses all of the common Western European languages with facilitate. He uses Russian in a very able fashion. A few years ago he was studying Chinese, so I understand he hasn't pushed that.
Oh, yes. That'd be a difficult one.
So he's able to go directly to the sources. I'm very happy that he's working in the field of Russian chemistry, because the Russians are apt to claim a great many things, and somebody needs to know whether the claims are correct or not. There have been a few truly great Russian chemists, and chemical activity in Russia at present is so great. But some of the claims that have been made have been a little bit far-fetched, like some of their other claims in the field of invention.
Yeah. They're propaganda.
They are.
Pure propaganda.
Really. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we should pursue Lester any further.
I think that's
the general background.
Yeah.
Other people who are active in the field in America, Sidney Edelstein, is the president of the Dexter Chemical Company, and Sid is the perpetual secretary of the History of Chemistry Division. The most hard-working person in an ACS division is always the secretary. The chairman is sort of a clod who does what the secretary tells him and then takes all the bowels. The secretaryship of these divisions is usually passed around from year to year. But something like 15 years ago, Sid pointed out that the division was just chugging along on one cylinder, and he had office facilities to handle this in routine fashion, so why didn't he just turn it over to his office, so he's been secretary for many years?
Is he an industrialist more than a chemist, or did he just combine the two in the chemistry?
It's a combination. Sid was trained in chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
And he and a partner set up the Dexter Chemical Company perhaps 2 decades ago, something like that. They deal in dye stuff ancillaries. That is, not dyes themselves, but things that are used in the dyeing process, like detergents and mordants, 1960s.
Oh,
so on.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
A very profitable business.
Gives them a lot of what you call the leisure time to carry on these.
Right, yeah. And it's one of these types of business that you sell an item that you bought by the ton, you sell it by the ounce. It goes quite a ways in the process, and the buyers aren't very much concerned about how badly it's overpriced. It has been a very profitable business, and as a result, Sid has been able to satisfy his interest in book collecting. He has a tremendous collection of Mr. Sinister books. He gets to Europe very frequently, prowls around the bookstalls there, and has a quite impressive collection. He's also interested in the history of dying, and his collection leans in that direction. He's published a good deal. Balls around the bookstall there, and has a quite impressive collection. He's also interested in the history of dying, and his collection leans in that direction. He's published a good deal. Sid has quite serious scholarly interests for an industrialist. Most of them don't dig very deep. But Sid has published a lot of very respectable stuff and a lot of human interest stuff. The dyers and colorists, I suppose, are much more interested in their history than most industrial groups are.
Mm-hmm.
And Sid has certainly been the spark that has brought this about. Another industrialist who's quite interested in history of chemistry has been I.D. Dean, whose book collection the university bought in 1950. And much of it is now housed in the book collection. Duveen is of English origin, took a degree in chemical engineering, and has been active in industrial chemistry circles since that time. Following the war, he came over to Long Island and started the Duveen Soap Company. And he also is a prosperous man who has indulged in book collecting. Mm-hmm. He has apparently been able to play the soap business in a way that has been quite profitable. And, he has made and sold two collections to date.
Oh.
He started out collecting books in history of chemistry and alchemy. And this collection was essentially complete around 1946. He had a catalog prepared, published, and then put his books on the market, and the UW Boston.
Mm-hmm.
This is the nucleus of our history of science collection.
Two collections like this?
No, we bought the Alchemical and Chemical history.
Yeah.
Then the university had just before this bought the Thordarson collection from Icelandic. Door County.
Yes.
So the two meshed together very well.
Oh, did Thordarson have an interest too in history of science?
Not chemistry.
Yeah.
There's very little chemistry in the Thordarson collection, except chemists who were also physicists or navigators or people like that.
Mm-hmm.
So the Duveen collection came here at that time, but Duveen retained the books dealing with Lavoisier and felt that he wished to limit his collecting to Lavoisier items. And in the past 10 years, he has scrounged France and picked up a lot of manuscripts, all of the books by Lavoisier or by his contemporaries or about Lavoisier. and some apparatus from Lavoisier's laboratory, making a quite complete collection, but he's apparently tired of this after he and Klickstein prepared a bibliography of Lavoisier items, and he has put this collection up for sale. I learned just the other day that Camille has bought it. We took a look at the list here, and in fact, that there were two more duplications to meet the price that was wanted by the dealer. So Camille gets that collection. Duveen has published some, usually in collaboration with Dr. Klickstein, Dr. Herbert Klickstein of Philadelphia, a radiologist who dabbles in history of science as an avocation. Some of Duveen's publications have been solo jobs, but much of it has been done in collaboration. Some of it's quite good stuff, some of it's well, a heck of it. Since Klickstein has turned up in this session, well, I have to say a word about him.
How do you spell that, by the way?
K-L-I-C-K-S-G-E-I-N. I'm not quite sure of Klickstein's education, but he is now a radiologist in one of the Philadelphia hospitals. But he has had a long time interest in history of chemistry, and put together a chart on the history of chemistry, a very extensive and complete chronological charting, which has been published by the Mallinckrodt Company in St. Louis, spelled Mallinckrodt. Klickstein also collaborated with Lester on the source book, and he has published numerous papers. Philadelphia, incidentally, could be a real center for history of chemistry, because the University of Pennsylvania holds the Edgar Fahs F.A.H.S. Smith collection. Smith was the first important professor of chemistry at the University of Pennsylvania. And he was a nut on history of chemistry, and had a rich wife so could indulge his whim for book collecting. And by the time he died, in the middle 20s, he had put together quite a sizable collection, which is really good for the University of Pennsylvania. And that is now housed as a unit of the Smith collection. Smith later became chairman of the chemistry department, and then became provost of the University of Pennsylvania. So that he was one of the big figures in that field. Smith was responsible in the 20s for starting the Division of History of Chemistry in the ACS, along with Charles Albert Brown of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Well, the Smith collection is available for scholars, though the University of Pennsylvania has never done justice to the collection. History of chemistry has been sort of a side issue in the university. I can't even think at the moment who teaches it. People from other parts of the country are going there to use the collection, which contains a splendid collection of the portraits of famous chemists. Though the collection is very deficient in 20th century figures, but it's very good up to the 20th century.
I didn't even interrupt.
Go ahead.
The American Philosophical
Society, yes,
is now engaged in a collaborative project, I believe it is, in collecting in the history of plants.
That's right,
it is. This is in Philadelphia.
This is in Philadelphia, yes. So Philadelphia is one of the centers that one might go to for study in history of science. Cambridge would be another, Madison would be still another.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that is just about it as far as major work is concerned.
Okay.
Yes.
And out here we will concentrate on the 20th century too, as far as...
Well, I suppose that we will concentrate on all time periods. You see, my society is interested in ancient and medieval times.
Yes, yes.
And Bill Salmon is interested in the ancient period. I am most interested in the 19th and 20th century. Stauffer is principally 19th century as a Hubert.
Mm-hmm.
We have a new man coming this year, Robert Siegfried, who is our first PhD in history of science, who will pursue chemistry in the period around 1800, so that he and I don't really clash one another. So I would say that our interests cover the entire time span.
There was another name that we had down here was Mr. Gerlach.
Yes, Henry Gerlach.
Henry Gerlach. Yeah. You didn't talk about him yet.
That's Gerlach. And Henry founded the History of Science Department at the University of Wisconsin about 1940 or 41.
Okay.
Was called into war work in Washington. I think it's amazing. He did a show for one during the war. And then took a position at Cornell around 1946. So this left the Wisconsin Fair open, and Stauffer was brought here right after that. And then there was enough enthusiasm for history of science that Claggett was brought thereafter, and it's now brought up to a fairly sizable department. In fact, the largest department in the subject anywhere in the world.
Really?
Yes.
Isn't that
so?
Is Gerlach at Cornell?
Gerlach is at Cornell now, and he has a moderately sizable operation. Pierce Williams has joined the staff there. I think that he and Williams are the only historians of science at Cornell. But they are giving the PhD degree and have a good sound operation going there. Their library facilities are growing, but not in the same class as Harvard, and as yet. Gerlach has rather wide-spreading interest, but has some interest in chemistry. He is doing much of his work in the period of the chemical revolution. This is the period around 1750 to 1800. This is when chemistry really got on the road as a science. Before that, it was messed up with alchemical ideas. And such people as Joseph Black, Henry Cavendish, Joseph Priestley, and of course, Lavoisier, steered it in the new direction that they've taken since that time. Gerlach is working in this field primarily. Just last year, he published a book dealing with Lavoisier's work during the year 1772. It's a sizable book dealing with just one year of activity. Of course, it's the interplay of Lavoisier and various other scientists of the day, and attempts to find out what stimulated Lavoisier to go off in the direction that he did.
Oh, it's just a watershed year.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Unless you have something more to say about Gerlach.
No, that's...
I just copied on E.B. Fred's name.
Yes.
We hadn't mentioned him in anything. I was just kind of backtracking.
Yes,
to get into
that's
the biochemist.
Right.
Is that all right?
This is all right.
And we have just a little bit of tape left.
Surely.
Would you care to make an observation on President Fred?
Yes.
As he's...
Well, I have never been as close to E.B. Fred as I have to any of the other people who have come up here. But we have had some contact, so I can perhaps make a few comments. He did a great deal to build the bacteriology department up to the position of prestige which it holds. He, like the biochemistry group, was exceedingly hard-working, drove his graduate students very hard, and learned a great deal as a result about soil bacteriology and fermentation. In my personal contact with him, I found him to be generally pretty serious and with a sort of one-track enthusiasm for the thing that he happens to be on at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
I've discussed my history of biochemistry project with him, and he's gotten quite excited about it and has volunteered all sorts of names of people that I could talk to.
Mm-hmm.
And to
mm-hmm.
has indicated a real willingness to give me every kind of help that he possibly can. So I hope to exploit this willingness very fully during the next month.